Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. The following is a message from Heritage Foods USA. Thanksgiving turkeys in America used to be different. They came from a wide variety of breeds. They were healthy and raised outdoors on small family farms. Their flavor? Exquisite. Continue this tradition with the same Heritage turkeys. Order yours now on www.heritagefoodsusa.com or call 718-389-0985. That's 718-389-0985.
Welcome to Straight No Chaser on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and we're broadcasting live from the back of Roberta's at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Brunch is being served. I do love that Thelonious Monk riff. That is just so cool. It just makes me feel way cooler than I really am. Anyway, I have a great show today. We'll be talking in just a couple of minutes with Ben Hewitt. Ben is the author of a new book called Making Supper Safe, One Man's Quest to Learn the Truth About Food Safety. I spend a lot of time reading trade blogs and newsletters about the food systems and especially about food safety. So I really enjoyed Ben's book, and I'm looking forward to grilling him about how we do make supper safe and what we should be worried about. So let's come right back in just a second with Ben Hewitt of Making Supper Safe. This is Straight No Chaser. Welcome to Straight No Chaser, Ben Hewitt. How you doing?
I'm great. How you doing, Katie?
Oh, great. I'm so glad you could join me today on the phone. I know you're up in Vermont, so thanks for taking the time out of your busy morning.
I'm happy to do it.
Are you farming up there?
Yeah, we've got a small farm. We've got about 40 acres.
Nice.
A little diversified operation.
Well, I was doing, I was at the gym earlier this week, one of the few times this week I went, and of course I read crummy magazines like People, and there was your review of... Now I can't even remember. I was so gobsmacked to see your byline there.
In People magazine?
Yeah, you had a review one of the other ones, like Marie Claire, or I don't know, one of those girly mags.
I really don't pay attention to them. Wait a minute. Someone
with your name, Ben, is reviewing books.
Okay, it's
books.
Another Ben Hewitt.
No way.
Yeah.
And here I was thinking I was so cool for having booked this guy who's like, you know, got his byline
no,
and these
out there
major mags.
Me.
That's what it is. I'm going to write to the editor right now. I'll be calling him right after this show.
I've got such a good life, and I'm so handsome. This happens all the time. So.
I believe it. I can see your picture on the back of your book jacket.
That was meant to be a joke, by the way.
So. No, I know. I'm just kidding.
Okay. Good
so,
enough.
Ben,
I just wanted to make sure
let's
we're clear
hear,
on that.
But let's hear all about who you are and why you started to write this book. What got you going?
Yeah, so, I operate a small diversified farm up in northern Vermont. And so I have a real interest in particularly small-scale food production and distribution. And the book also sort of evolved out of my first book, which is called The Town That Food Saved, which was about an economically challenged community up here in Vermont that's sort of trying to reinvigorate its community by creating a healthy, small-scale food system, localized food system. And, as I was sort of reporting that book, one of the things I realized is that one of the greatest impediments to creating viable small-scale ag-based food-based businesses is the regulatory system around food, which is almost always tilted in the favor of large-scale commodity production.
Sure.
And it's almost always around the issue of food safety. And so I became really sort of intrigued, I wanted to dig into that and see what are the real issues here. And one of the interesting things that happened, early on in my reporting, maybe I was about a third to half the way through the book, was I really started getting intrigued by the whole issue of the human body and its relation to bacteria. And should we be asking sort of perhaps larger questions about our response to these foodborne illness outbreaks? And we can, you know, we can talk more about that as we get into this conversation.
Well, let's keep going with this bacteria idea, because I did see, I mean, the book opens with a chapter about dumpster diving with,
right.
you know, some guy, which
yeah.
was really totally hilarious. You're a very funny writer. I really enjoyed it. And then, you know, you go on to the larger questions of, you know, Pasteur versus, of course, his name is escaping me now, but another scientist who was saying
yep.
that, you know, we really need to have more bacteria, not less of it. And that,
right.
let's keep going on that, because I think that's a very interesting idea.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, one of the reasons I kicked the book off with the dumpster diving chapter is I really wanted to alert people early on, you know, in addition to it being sort of a fun scene and you know, sort of, you know, I hope anyway, lively and engaging scene, I really wanted to alert people that this is maybe not the food safety book they were expecting if they were just sort of expecting to
yeah,
read
definitely.
About, you know, young kids dying of E. coli and all that, which, you know, I just want to say right now that does happen and that's very tragic.
Indeed, it does, absolutely.
But one of the things, you know, that whole dumpster diving episode, and spending time with this friend of mine, who I learned over the course of writing this book, does source a lot of his calories, about a third to half of his calories out of the trash, was one of the things that really started to inform my thinking on this whole issue of bacteria, and that maybe we're thinking about it, you know, we're kind of thinking in a box, I guess, and it's a box that has been built and designed by a pharmaceutical industry that would like us to believe that, you know, we should always do everything we can to live in a very clean, if not sterile, environment. So, you know, when I learned that this guy was eating so much out of the trash, I became super intrigued because he'd been doing this for about 10 years. There's only one time in those 10 years that he can attribute his diet to actually making him ill. So the reason I found this interesting is because, according to the CDC, at the time, the CDC has since revised their numbers, but at the time, this was about a year and a half ago, the CDC was telling us that there were about 74 million cases of foodborne illness a year, annually, in the U.S. And so I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, that's like, you know, enough for 25% of Americans basically to have an episode of foodborne illness. And yet here's a guy who's eating out of the trash, which, you know, has to put him in one of the highest risk categories you can imagine.
Sure.
And he's, you know, he's saying that in 10 years there's once that he's been sickened by acute foodborne illness. I have actually since come to believe that that one episode was not acute foodborne illness, because it was an episode where he became ill very, very shortly, like within hours of consuming the product. And the reality of most of these bacterium is that it takes anywhere from days to weeks. They have an incubation period of days to weeks before you actually will sort of suffer the symptoms.
Well, that's what makes it so hard to trace them back, isn't it?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So, you know, I started looking into more of the, you know, okay, so why is this guy, if there's so much foodborne illness out there, why is this guy not getting sick?
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of the, you know, the sort of root question that I started wanting to feel like I had, you know, felt like I had to answer, at least to my own satisfaction.
Absolutely. I would want to know that. So did you come to any conclusions?
Yeah, well, I came to a conclusion that satisfies me, right?
Let's hear it
that way. And I think, you know, my conclusion is that, I mean, there's a couple of things. One, in a very sort of odd way, this fellow, you're going to have to sort of, you know, bear with me here for a second, but he's actually fairly careful about what he eats. In other
mm-hmm.
words, you know, I'd had this assumption that, you know, we were going to be, like, you know, hanging out in back of Burger King and Pizza Hut and whatever, but he wouldn't touch that stuff with a 10-foot pole.
Is that right?
He wouldn't go in the front door of one of those places and eat that stuff, you know, from off the tray.
Right.
Because he just thinks, you know, he sees that as absolutely, you know, disgusting junk food. But he is, so he's very selective in this strange way about where he dives. So he dives in very, you know, a sort of, he sort of goes around to these producers. We live in a region where there's a lot of sort of, you know, high-end artisanal food production, and that's what he seeks out. The other thing, I think, is that a big part of his diet, in addition to the food he's finding in the trash, he eats a lot of fermented foods. Like sauerkraut, kimchi, yogurt, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things I found as I was researching this book is that fermented foods are really, really rich in a wide diversity of bacterium and enzymes. And so when you eat them, you're basically populating your gut with these sort of healthy bacteria. You know, we think of bacteria, I think this is really sad, we have this kind of, I think, cultural phobia of bacteria. So we hear bacteria and we automatically think, you know, oh, that's something I got to protect myself from, right? But the reality is there are 9 to 10 bacterial cells in your body for every human cell. So you are actually more them than you are.
Shazam.
If that makes sense, right?
Yeah, right.
So, you know, which can only lead me to sort of, you know, the only assumption you can draw from that is that actually bacteria, you know, are all around us. They're part of us. They're actually very essential to our well-being. We think of, even if you think of like E. coli, okay, someone says E. coli, and you think, oh, I got to avoid that. You know, you have been sort of infected, if you will, with E. coli since the day you were born, okay? And there are 700-plus varieties of E. coli. There's only a handful that can actually make you ill. So the reality is I think, you know, owing to a few news headlines, we've become, and owing to an industry that would very much like to sell us microbial hand wipes, you know, antimicrobial hand wipes and soaps, you know, we've become incredibly sensitive and paranoid to the idea that there is bacteria in our food, when the reality is it's really essential to have bacteria in our food and healthy bacteria in our food, because that's what creates, the term is terrain, that's what creates an internal terrain that provides, you know, health and vitality and well-being, so much so that when you are, if you are, exposed to a bacteria that can make you ill, you have the capacity to fight it off.
Well, that makes some sense to me, but I have to say that I think that in the early days of pasteurization, for example, just as the most primary example of when we started to clean up our food, it was kind of essential to do it, and people were succumbing to foodborne illnesses at a much greater rate. There was a lot more tuberculosis, Campylobacter. I mean, there was tons of stuff in milk that needed to be extracted, and unfortunately, this program is not long enough for us to have a debate about raw milk, but I would love to talk to you about that, because you had a really great chapter about it. And I'm going to do something about raw milk in the future. But
let me just really briefly address exactly what you're talking about. You know, I'm not here to champion raw milk or pasteurized milk or anything. I think there's no question that pasteurization, which sort of came widely into use in the 1930s, roughly, was, you know, at least in the short term, a very a great public health benefit, no question about that. But part of the reason was that the conditions in which we were keeping our dairy livestock in that day and age were absolutely rapacious. It was disgusting. They were mostly located in cities, and they lived in these sort of, they called them swill dairies, and they were fed off from the mash, the leftover mash from distilleries. And so basically the sanitation was absolutely, you know, abhorrent. It was horrific. And so there was no question that, you know, when pasteurization came along and we were able to basically cook that milk, to the point where it wasn't carrying these bacterium that could make people sick, there was a precipitous drop in I'm not even gonna say foodborne, I'm gonna say dairy-borne, you know, acute dairy-borne illness. No, you're absolutely right on that. So yeah, this is not sort of a black and white thing. You know, there is definitely sort of shades of gray here, and we should acknowledge that.
Yeah, I'm all for the shades of gray. I mean, I see way too much black and white in people's conversations about food and the food system and the way we eat here and now in the United States.
You know, you talk about black. I mean, raw milk. I mean, there's, you know, it's such an emotional issue.
I know, and why?
Well, you know, I don't really know.
I
think people, I actually think I do know. I think it's because people see it as an issue of food rights as much as they see it as any particular food product.
Yeah.
And I feel this too, you know. I feel like no one really has the right to tell me what food I should be able to procure and consume. And, you know, unfortunately, the federal agencies that regulate our food system just don't agree with that view. There's no question, strictly speaking, looking at the numbers, the hard numbers, even according to the FDA and the USDA, raw milk doesn't even make the top 10 of their most dangerous foods, and yet they are, you know, they're on a pretty serious campaign to lean on
to shut it down.
Raw milk producers.
There are quite a few outbreaks.
Again, not to advocate for raw milk or anything,
right,
but pasteurization is not a panacea. The most recent deaths associated with milk in this country are from pasteurized milk. So, We need to recognize that.
Well, I you know, like you, I follow Bill Marler with great, you know, our
right.
time is like ticking away here. Let's take a 30-second break, Ben.
Okay.
Stay on the phone, and then we regroup because we only have 10 minutes left and there's so much more to talk about. You're going to come back.
All right.
Welcome back to Straight No Chaser on the HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We are broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, and my name is Katie Kiefer. On the line with me is author Ben Hewitt. His book, Making Supper Safe, One Man's Quest to Learn the Truth About Food Safety, is our topic today. And Ben, we just got veered off into the whole raw milk thing. I think we have to have another whole show about that. So I'm gonna jump you next to the segment that discusses, I mean, you broke your book out into primary food groups like meat, eggs, milk, seeds, as in like, you know, Monsanto type GMO seeds, aquaculture, and and that's it. And so let me ask you this, what were the things, could you give me like a thumbnail of like what were the things that scared you the most about each one of these food groups?
You know, I think what scares me the most about dairy, it gets back to that issue of food rights, and that, you know, a lot of the regulations that are in place right now around food, and a lot of, you know, almost always again about around the issue of food safety, make it very, very difficult for the implementation of small-scale food systems, which I think is, you know, if you really want to get to the, you know, what's the solution to all this, and actually Bill Marler agrees with me on this,
I'm sure
is that
does.
We need, you know, we need to totally rethink our food system. It's just gone off the rails, and that we need to get to a place where we are re-regionalizing food production so that we don't have situations, facilities where, you know, one source point of contamination can sicken literally tens of thousands of people. That's what we've got going on right now. Okay, let's talk about meat for a second.
Sure. My favorite
thing that,
subject.
You know, and I'm going to try to make this really quick, but it's going to be hard. the issue with meat that really freaks me out the most is the issue of drug-resistant bacterium.
Yeah.
Owing to the practice of feeding subtherapeutic, subclinical doses of antibiotics to livestock. Okay, 75% of the antibiotics produced in this country are fed to our livestock for the purposes of growth promotion.
Yep.
The problem is this thing called lateral gene transfer, LGT. What happens is the animals are eating these antibiotics. The bacterium that are in their bodies are slowly becoming resistant to the antibiotics. All right, and what happens is that the what's called the resistance genes in those bacterium can actually insert themselves into bacterium, you know, basically across the spectrum. So they can actually insert themselves into other species of bacterium. So this isn't about, you know, you, Katie, going out and like kissing a cow and catching, you know, drug resistant salmonella or E. coli
right.
from it. This is about the broader dissemination of these resistance genes throughout our society.
Well, I'll just interrupt you for a second and say that the biggest example of that is the recent recall of ground turkey by Cargill, which was contaminated with Salmonella Heidelberg, which is resistant to all of the cephalexin, cephalosporin,
right.
blah, 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 drugs widely used in human consumption.
It was the same issue with what was going on in Germany earlier this year. That variant of E. coli was particularly dangerous because they couldn't find anything to kill it.
Right.
So, you know, what's going on right now is that, you know, we have a situation where we have, no one knows for sure, but most estimates I got where we have six figures, so over 100,000 Americans dying annually because of drug-resistant bacterium. And this is happening, a lot of this, given the fact that we feed 3/4 of our antibiotics to livestock, you know, it's very clear that a lot of this is coming, a lot of these deaths could be traced back to the way we raise meat in this country.
And yet the pharmaceutical industry and the livestock industry vociferously deny that there is any connection whatsoever between
Oh, sure.
human resistance, or, you
yes.
know, resistant
Absolutely.
Bugs. in humans and what they've been doing with livestock for the last, it's really only been about 25 years that they've been have incorporated this regime of adding antibiotics regularly.
Right, and you know, and people have this assumption that it's because it's to keep the animals, you know, quote unquote healthy, so they don't get sick from each other because they're
part of that is that, yeah.
Part of it is, but the primary reason, and what I find is so, you know, infuriating about all this is that. The primary reason is growth promotion.
Sure.
And again, it gets back to bacterium. When you take an antibiotic as a human or feed it to an animal, it goes into your gut. It kills not only the bacterium it's designed to kill, but it also kills a lot of other bacterium. So it allows you to actually, you don't have that competitive environment for the uptake of calories. So when those animals are fed, they uptake their calories a little bit more efficiently in the order of, depending on the species, you know, 2 to 8%. So for, you know, a handful of percentage gain in profits, essentially, you know, we are, as a culture, a society, being sort of forced to assume the risk of these rampant drug-resistant bacterium. You know, we have stopped giving antibiotics to certain categories of human patients right now. For instance, late-stage cancer patients, we used to just give them antibiotics as a matter of course because we knew it would save some of their lives because their immune system was so depleted.
Mm-hmm.
We have stopped doing that because we're afraid of creating drug-resistant bacterium in our medical system. So at the very same time that we have decided to let certain sectors of patients die earlier than they would have, the livestock industry is continuing to feed 75% of the antibiotics produced in this country to its animals. So, you know, it's absolutely insane what's going on.
Yeah, it's pretty. It's very frightening. I mean, the bugs are evolving faster than we can develop new antibiotics for them. So, you know, bacteria evolve, parasites evolve, things
That's right.
develop their resistance,
yeah.
and they do it very quickly because their turnover is.
Right.
It's like, you know, breeding traits in and out of livestock. You know, you do it in 3 or 4 generations. The same thing happens within a cellular structure, but it happens that much faster. One of the things that I wanted to bring up with you is, like, especially since we're talking about the meat industry, which is a particular interest of mine, is I recently, you know, about a year ago, I visited a Cargill processing plant out in Colorado, and I was, mm-hmm. I have to say, I was wildly impressed with the level of care and, you know, and money that they had invested in identifying places where bacteria could grow and trying to eliminate that possibility. They seem to take their food safety extremely seriously. Of course, as you pointed out, they're dealing in millions and millions of pounds of product, which can be contaminated by one source. So it really stands to reason that they do make that investment. But what could they do? What more could they do? I mean, granted that I don't think Cargill is going to be going away anytime soon.
Right.
What more could happen that would make our food supply, especially things like ground beef patties, you know, pre-processed foods, which, you know, convenience foods that are really almost always the primary cause of foodborne illnesses. What could they do that was better, do you think?
Well, you know, having not visited a Cargill plant as you have, you may have in some ways a little more insight into this question than I do. But I guess, you know, one thing they could do is to stop the practices of combining meat from, in some cases, dozens of animals into, you know, when you go to buy one of those preformed, you know, burger patties at Costco or wherever it is that you buy it, you're buying, you know, burgers that are made from the bits and pieces of, you know, sometimes dozens, if not more, animals. So there's, you know, there's such a sort of...
Hundreds, if not thousands. I mean,
exactly.
If you're talking about a plant...
There's no way to really know. But so, you know, people have this idea of, like, excuse me, you know, when they buy a burger, they think of, you know, they're, you know, going down to the butcher and you get, you know, he takes the chuck roast or whatever it is and he sticks it in the grinder and out this other end comes this, you know, fresh ground meat. You know, that's like 180 degrees from what's going on in these large scale meat production facilities. And so, you know, again, it gets back to that, you know, I'm glad to hear that you were impressed and that they have all of those sort of, stopgaps in place. It's so essential because there are just so many ways and places for this stuff to enter into the system, particularly when these are your practices. You know, I'm still going to argue that no matter how careful you are, unless you get to a place where you're irradiating everything that's coming out of these factories, which would be horrible for us, long-term health, there is no way to eliminate the risk of this stuff. And so I think we need to acknowledge that, because as consumers, the more that we demand for the elimination of risk, the more we're going to see regulations that are going to really make it difficult for small-scale production to thrive. And that's what we need to understand. We need to recognize that there is an inherent safety advantage in regionalized food production, and Bill Marler would absolutely agree with me on this, and he's much more of a hawk than I am regarding, you know, regarding this stuff. And, you know, we need to understand that if you have, as Bill likes to say, okay, this is a great quote from Bill Marler, you know, just because you can shake the hand of the guy who sold you your dinner doesn't mean he's not going to poison you. But at least you'll know where to
find him.
Spoken
like a true litigator.
Right?
We should backtrack just for a second. I want to let listeners know that Bill Marler is one of the primary attorneys in the Marler and Clark law firm, which I don't know if people remember the big E. coli story that was in the New York Times and won a Pulitzer a couple of years ago about the girl Stephanie, whatever her name was, who the dancer. It's in your book, but anyway. And he litigated for her, but he's litigated many, many, many foodborne illness cases and has a very strict, as you point out in your book, a very strict criteria for what determines his willingness to take on a case or not. He is the rock star of food safety. He has an innumerable number of blogs, posts, newsletters, etc. I urge
people
to...
Oh, the guy is he must not sleep. I mean,
And he has a great team of reporters working for him. I mean, they really are superb. I'm really hoping to get him on the show in the future because I'd love to keep talking about food safety. But do you think that, I mean, one of the, just to bring up Bill Marler, you quoted Bill in your book, the job of FSIS, which is the Food Safety Inspection Services, is supposed to be ensuring public health. It isn't supposed to be finding a balance between Cargill and making an extra 2 cents per pound of hamburger and ensuring public health. I mean, what's the role of government in all of this? I mean, we were talking earlier about, you know, raw milk and how objectionable it is to have the government tell us what we can eat. And yet, at the same time, we really need government regulations to make our food system safer and to eliminate these conflicts of interest between corporate, you know, interests and the guys who are making our laws.
Right.
So what's your take on that?
I don't want it to sound like I'm a fan of deregulation. I'm not. I think there absolutely is a role for government. What I think, again, though, we need to come back to acknowledging that, you know, small-scale food production has an inherent safety advantage just in regards to the scale.
Yeah.
So, you know, what I would like to see is instead of having the government and the FDA expending so many resources, and Bill probably would not agree with me on this one, but, you know, be that as it may, expending so many resources chasing small-scale producers of raw milk when, you know, the consumers who are purchasing that product are, you know, really that's a product they want and are acknowledging and I think by and large accepting that risk. Instead of having them expend those kind of resources, I want to see them expend resources going after the large-scale producers and really keeping tabs on them. I mean, right now we have a situation where the FDA inspects a given facility only once every 7 years.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah,
scary.
I think there's no question we need a little, we need, you know, more muscular regulation, but we have to, you know, again, it has to be tiered in a way that does not disadvantage small-scale food producers, and that's what we've got right now.
I'm agreeing with you 100%, but I will play devil's advocate here for a second and say the following, which is that small-scale producers do not have the resources to put into place the kinds of safety mechanisms that something like Cargill can, and I think that that's a real risk that people should be aware of in terms of small-scale production as well. You are not going to have an infrared or an ultraviolet light that shows organic fecal material on your raw carcass the way Cargill does when they before they send it down the line and then they power wash it. You know, it's like, I mean, these, it's like, yes, you can say that these safety regulations are inherently skewed towards large producers, but at the same time, it's also important that small producers observe the same protocols, whether it's animal welfare approved or certified humane or it's going to be super clean or whatever it is. I mean, they have to toe that line too. Not that they have to install ultraviolet lights, but they do have to you know, observe a very significant measure of safety protocols in order to make their food, our regionalized food supply safe.
You know, yeah, I don't disagree with that, but I think that, you know, I mean, really what I'm talking about here, and this may not, is not going to sit well with everyone, is people becoming much more, and what, you know, what I would argue we need for all sorts of reasons, not just food safety. I mean, we have to move away from an agricultural system that is, you know, agriculture right now is the large, as a sector, the largest user of energy in our country. It's
absolutely
one of our
and
greatest
water.
Sort of, it's one of our greatest vulnerabilities, mm-hmm. basically, from all sorts of standpoints. Consumers, if you will, I sort of hate the word consumer because it sounds so sort of, it sounds so black.
Anti-people.
People aren't really, engaging. That's exactly what we need the opposite of. We need people to become not just consumers but participants in their food system.
I agree.
People on a regional level sort of taking the time. I mean, this is like the most important commerce you engage in on a regular basis, right? On a day-to-day basis, this is something that you're putting into your body. I mean, there's nothing more, unless you're going to a prostitute or something, there's nothing more intimate, no more intimate form of commerce. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do.
And so I think we've come to a place culturally where, we're totally disengaged and we want to just like hand over all the responsibility for the production and for the oversight of this commerce to other people. And that's just not, that has a very short historical precedent. I mean, we're talking, really 50, 60 years that
Absolutely.
It's been like that. So what I would argue we're living through right now, and this is getting to way bigger issues than E. coli and salmonella and whatever, but what I think we're living in the aberration, right? We're living in this strange little weird little bubble where we can sort of quote unquote afford to have this distance from our food, and it's going to come back around for innumerable reasons. And so I think that we need to sort of as consumers / participants, the future is going to be having a much more participatory nature relationship with our food. And not necessarily expecting that it's something that we can just leave to everyone else.
To either the producer or the government. Well, Ben, unfortunately, we have to wrap this up. So I'm going to ask you to just let people know if Making Supper Safe is available in any bookstore and on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc. And also, do you have any readings coming up or any events that people should know about? We do reach a pretty big audience.
I just finished off a very intense period of that. I would have to look at my website, at my appearances.
What is your website?
What's coming next. But I would, if people want to keep tabs on what I'm up to, they can go to benhewitt.com. .net, and that has my appearances, that has links to order my books, and actually has some writings on more of my thoughts regarding the food system and relocalizing economies around the issue around small scale agriculture.
Well, you have been an absolutely fabulous guest. I hope we will do this again. I'd love, there's like many, many topics in that book that I would love to address with you. So let's, we'll talk after the show.
That sounds great.
Thank you so much for joining me today on Straight No Chaser. Many thanks to my producer and engineer, Jack Inslee. Next week, we'll be with Alex Prudhomme, the best selling author of My Life in Provence, but who is coming out with a new book right now called The Ripple Effect, all about our water system. So please do come back and join us again next week on Sunday for Straight No Chaser. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. Thanks so much, and I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a message from Jones Family Farms. Jones Family Farms is a 400-acre working farm offering quality agricultural products all year round, from fresh summer berries to Christmas trees in the winter, and an award-winning winery that is open from April to December. The reach of the Jones Family Farms is hard to capture, from their advocacy work through the Working Lands Alliance to ongoing classes in the Harvest Kitchen. Jones Family Farms is as passionate about education as it is about farming. Whether you're picking fresh strawberries or exploring local wines, we hope you're inspired to learn more about Connecticut farming. Visit www.jonesfamilyfarms.com for more information.